supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
New Jersey Governor Chris Christie delivered his final budget address to lawmakers in Trenton today.
So a private sector that's growing jobs, a public sector that's shrinking jobs, cutting taxes, and investing in a more vibrant economy, a long-term commitment to our transportation infrastructure, a strategic investment in our higher education campuses to bolster a stronger, smarter workforce, and to keep New Jersey students in New Jersey.
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Joining me is NJ Spotlight's John Reitmeier. He was on hand to hear that address and joins us now with details. John, welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you. Thanks for having me again.
Well, to hear that clip, everything seems to be going great in New Jersey, but let's get into the details. Where shall we start? Public employee pension funding, perhaps?
Sure, and that's been a big issue for the governor throughout his tenure. This is his last budget address, and at one point he had promised that by this fiscal year that will start in July, we would reach full funding of the public employee pension obligation. In the budget that he's proposing, it's half funding of what the obligation is. So we're going to put in, the state is going to put into the pension fund about $2.5 billion. To be fair, that's still a record for one governor in one single budget. But it's far short of what actuaries say should be going into that pension fund to fix an underfunding problem that's been lingering for a few decades now.
And interestingly, to get closer to the goal, the governor's proposing, or he's certainly eyeing, lottery proceeds.
The governor had said prior to the speech there would be some surprise, and he lived up to that. That was one of the surprises. We don't have a lot of details on this proposal yet, and lawmakers, interestingly right now, aren't writing it off or summarily dismissing it. There's a proposal that sounds like a rededication of lottery revenues. Right now, the state lottery is dedicated to funding, you know, payouts to those who win, staff salary, and also certain revenues are dedicated to things like veteran services and tuition assistance. It sounds like the governor would be proposing rededicating, it could be up to $1 billion a year into the pension fund instead, which could sure use the money. But on the back end, that might create a budget hole. We'll have to see how the numbers work on that.
Let's move on to public schools. Once again, the governor.
The SFRA disaster that fittingly caps decades of misguided educational funding experimentation by lawmakers and courts has to stop. Similar to tax fairness, school funding fairness cannot be imposed by a governor acting alone.
John, let's put aside his phrasing that sounds an awful lot like the president invoking the word disaster. What is the SFRA?
The School Funding Reform Act of 2008. The state is supposed to be following a formula that it basically there's a set amount of money for each student and then extra for different things like English as a second language or special education. And so funding is supposed to be allotted for each district running this formula. Unfortunately, the formula really has never been fully funded. Been short about $1 billion to $2 billion over the length of Christie's tenure. And so there are some distortions now in how the numbers get run each year. This budget basically provides flat funding for school districts in New Jersey, which they would argue is a cut because their costs are continuing to go up with inflation. There was some concern headed into this that the governor would try and write a drastic revision of the school funding formula and sort of shoehorn it into the budget somehow. That didn't happen, though in the speech he called on lawmakers to work with him to overhaul the funding formula and fix some of these inequities that have developed over the last few years. Talking to lawmakers after the speech, it sounds like they're more interested in keeping the current formula intact but making some tweaks around the edges and not doing this gross overhaul that the governor called for and that he called for in 100 days. So it sounds like lawmakers are willing to work in that area, but definitely are not willing to do everything that the governor asked for in the speech today.
Seemed to be a challenge, if not a threat, to get it done in 100 days collaboratively, or he would proceed his own way.
Some in the room certainly heard it as a threat, although the assembly speaker said he preferred to use your word, he preferred to see it as simply a challenge.
bereft of tax increases, to what extent can revenue projections be accurate in the face of what isn't known yet about what's happening from the White House?
So that's a really good question, and it was largely avoided today. There was no mention by the governor of some of this talk about maybe ending the Affordable Care Act, turning Medicaid into a block grant program. If those two issues items were to happen, it would have a significant impact on New Jersey's budget.
Thanks, John.
You're welcome.
NJ Spotlight's John Reitmeier on NewsWorks Tonight. President Donald Trump took his first stab at removing environmental regulations today. Surrounded by farmers, home builders, and county commissioners, the president eliminated plans to protect small wetlands and streams. State Impact Pennsylvania's Susan Phillips reports on what's next for the Waters of the U.S. rule.
The Waters of the U.S. rule is a long, wonky document crafted by the EPA under President Obama. It tried to eliminate decades of confusion over what small water bodies would be protected by the Clean Water Act. Congress defined protected waters as navigable, which left a lot up to interpretation and led to lawsuits. Farmers, home builders, and golf course owners like Donald Trump didn't like how the EPA defined these waters. So Trump has scrapped the current rule and told the EPA to go back to the drawing board.
A few years ago, the EPA decided that navigable waters can mean nearly every puddle or every ditch on a farmer's land or any place else that they decide, right?
Yes, sir.
It was a massive power grab.
Actually, the rule didn't include every puddle or ditch, but it did protect certain wetlands or streams that don't contain water all year round, like Delaware's Delmarva Bays. Ellen Galinsky worked for the EPA under Obama and helped craft the rule. She says farm activity was exempt.
So really, most of their fears were not based in fact. And I found to a farmer, every time I went out and talked to them one-on-one, they seemed relieved when I left. But, you know, of course, I can't visit every farm in the country.
The process to rewrite the rule could take years and also be subject to lawsuits by environmentalists who fear the EPA under Trump would be too lax. Susan Phillips, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
Pennsylvanians vote for Republican and Democratic congressional representatives in roughly even numbers across the Commonwealth. But Republicans hold 13 of the state's 18 seats. The League of Women Voters and others say that's because district boundaries are gerrymandered. Now they're leading an effort to change the way legislative lines are drawn. WHYY's Dave Davies says there is evidence that the movement's picking up steam, especially since President Trump took office.
When a coalition of groups called Fair Districts PA called a meeting at Upper Dublin High School to talk about gerrymandering, no one quite expected this. More than 600 people showed up to hear Carol Cunningham of the League of Women Voters give a 40-minute slide presentation about how political parties draw district lines to gain advantage and why she says it's harmful. One example, splitting up Montgomery County, which has enough people to merit its own congressional representative.
Your county should have one congressional district, and your congressman should be thinking about nothing but you. Instead, you have five congressional districts, and I promise you, your congressmen are not thinking about you.
In Pennsylvania, congressional districts are drawn by leaders in the state legislature. And when Harrisburg is dominated by Republicans, that benefits the GOP. Pennsylvania's 7th congressional district in the western Philadelphia suburbs is one of the most bizarre-looking anywhere, literally a poster child of gerrymandering. At one point, it's just about 300 feet wide, and it's been featured in stories across the country. It's a bipartisan tradition, though. In Maryland, Democrats have crafted some twisted districts for their benefit. Cunningham says you can see many poor cities in Pennsylvania that are carved into multiple districts and suffer for the lack of dedicated representation. And she says safe Republican and Democratic districts contribute to partisan gridlock because the only threats to incumbents are primary challengers from zealots in their respective parties.
In this current system, The values that are rewarded are not moderation, not collaboration, not problem solving, but extremism. As you draw those safe districts, you push the elections to the extreme.
Some states use independent commissions to draw boundaries, and Fair Districts PA proposes a bipartisan 11-member commission of non-politicians to do the job, roughly modeled on the system used in California. Putting it in place would require a change in the state constitution, which is a steep legislative hill to climb. The bill would have to pass two successive sessions of the legislature, then win voter approval in a referendum. Could it happen? The most powerful Republican in the state legislature, Senate Majority Leader Jake Corman, says the independent panel is maybe a noble idea.
The problem is there's no such thing as an independent person. I mean, everyone has some sort of political bias, whether you're a university professor or Sally Homemaker at home. They all have some sort of political feeling, bias.
Lawmakers, Corman says, are at least accountable to voters. Critics say they're only accountable to voters in safely gerrymandered districts. Fair Districts PA is getting big turnouts, in part because progressives are energized by the election of Donald Trump. To succeed, the movement will need broader support. The group's redistricting bill does have bipartisan sponsors, and it's holding events throughout the state. The Conservative Commonwealth Foundation is a part of the coalition. Rick Taylor, a former state representative from Montgomery County, says Republican leaders in the legislature aren't going to welcome change. But he says there's a way to get their attention.
If we get enough people out saying this is important, pressuring the legislators, they're going to go to their caucuses, they're going to speak up, and it's going to force the hands of the leaders.
Another front could open in the redistricting battle. Litigation. For 20 years, cases charging partisan gerrymandering have failed in the courts, but a panel of federal judges recently struck down districts drawn by Wisconsin's legislature. In that case, plaintiffs presented a mathematical formula for measuring gerrymandering. Ben Geffen of the Public Interest Law Center says when you apply those standards here,
Pennsylvania is either the worst in the country or one of the three or four worst states in the country.
Geffen says his firm has been approached by potential plaintiffs for a case in Pennsylvania. One potential benefit for activists is that discovery in the case might uncover memos and emails that illuminate the motives of those who crafted the state's current congressional maps. Dave Davies, WHYY News.
The city of Philadelphia is 58 days out from hosting its first NFL draft since 1961. It's expected to bring big crowds, big TV viewership, and big exposure for Philadelphia. WHYY's Tom McDonald reports that taxpayer dollars won't be needed to help it happen.
It is going to be absolutely spectacular. The draft has never been done like this before, the Philadelphia way.
Former Eagles quarterback Ron Jaworski turned into a cheerleader when he spoke about the draft, the annual selection of top college players trying to break into pro football. He says the event, which has been on the road for the past 2 years, is a major spectacle. Larry Needle of PHL Sports, a division of the Convention and Visitors Bureau, says the hospitality business will definitely notice.
Nearly 40,000 hotel room nights. $80 million plus in economic impact, 1,700 members of the media coming in.
The event costs approximately $25 million to stage. The city's responsible for about $5 million for security and other city services. Needle says private fundraising has already generated about 70%. Peter O'Reilly, the NFL's senior vice president of events, says the entertainment will stretch from the Art Museum to the Franklin Institute, a span that would cover 25 football fields. A temporary 3,000-seat theater will be assembled at the top of the Art Museum steps.
A lot of people obviously want to be in the theater, and it's a great experience, and you're there, and the prospects are there across the 3 days. But the experience in the Parkway is pretty great. If you want to, there's a little bit of everything, whether if you're a fan who wants to go to the Draft Tavern on the Parkway and drink a beer and see what's going on, or if you want to, with your family, and you want to go to the kids' area.
Mayor Jim Kenney says this will be an inclusive event, not one that scares people out of the Art Museum area, as some businesses say happened during the Pope's visit.
In many ways, elements of the government during the Pope are telling people to stay away. That's not the message you want to give. You want people to come to Philadelphia, the Parkway. You want them to come to the Reading Terminal Market, to Market Street, to South Broad Street, to the neighborhoods, to Baltimore Avenue, to South Philly, to Passyunk.
And while Philadelphia may have had plenty of international exposure during the papal visit and Democratic National Convention, this event will likely reach people who didn't tune in for either of those. Football fans looking to get their hands on some free seats for the draft will have to enter a lottery beginning next week. I'm Tom McDonald, WHYY News.
Today marks the 75th anniversary of a German submarine attack off the coast of Cape May, New Jersey. Let's look back and then ahead with Bob Heinle, historian with the Mid-Atlantic Center for the Arts and Humanities. Dr. Bob, welcome to NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be participating in the show.
And so, placing this date, it's less than 3 months after the U.S. was drawn into the war following Pearl Harbor.
Mm-hmm.
Take us back to that intervening period. To what extent had the U.S. and specifically New Jersey and the shoreline ramped up for what was to come?
Well, it was a very hurried thing. We were in the middle of frantic preparations in 1941. Our coastal defenses were inadequate. We hadn't even learned about blackouts as yet. We fully underestimated both the danger and the type of danger that we were going to be under. Down here in Cape May, the Army built a coastal fortification both here on Cape May and across the bay at Cape Henlopen and called Fort Miles, with the coastal artillery designed to fight off German surface ships and a possible amphibious invasion, both of which never occurred, and we greatly underestimated the peril from submarines. Most of the submarine fighting here was done out of what was then a Navy base. We know it today as the Coast Guard base.
How far offshore did this attack take place on the USS Jacob Jones?
About 20 miles offshore. Her crewman called her the Jakey. And the Jakey had just been chasing a German U-boat, which had sunk a tanker further north in New Jersey. As dawn broke, was about to give up the chase when the submarine got it, and it was hit by at least two torpedoes, perhaps three, and sunk very quickly. Almost all the crewmen were killed, with the exception of about 25 or 30. But then that number was further decimated when the bow part the stern, where all the depth charges were located, sunk, and that set off the depth charges, and that killed all but 13 of the remaining crew, who were then brought into Cape May. 12 made it. One died on the way in. This attack in the Jacob Jones was the first American warship sunk by enemy action after Pearl Harbor.
What was the strategic importance of this strip of coastline to both the U.S. and to Germany?
This area was at the mouth of the extremely strategic Delaware Bay and River. What with the Navy Yard up there, all the refineries, many other war industries, the Germans had made it a first priority on the East Coast to, if you will, somehow put a cork in the mouth of the Delaware Bay and stop things from going in and out. For example, I mentioned the oil refineries. It wasn't just any oil. It was high-octane aviation gas that came out of Philadelphia, and about half of all the aviation gas that the United States used in the Mediterranean, Italy, North African, and eventually European theater came out of this bay. So you can see why it was so important to strangle that flow of just that one vital supply.
Even though I presume the U.S. was subsequently sensitive to the potential for German submarines, Germany was able to sink apparently 10 ships within a mile of the New Jersey coast.
Yes, yes. This was a very dangerous spot, especially, you know, when we're talking about 41, 42, early 43, until our tactics and technology caught up with and indeed surpassed the German submarine warfare technology. Things like sonar and radar and convoys and extended range for aerial surveillance by both airplanes and blimps.
Dr. Bob, thanks so much for shedding light on this date 75 years ago.
It's been my pleasure.
Bob Heinle, historian with the Mid-Atlantic Center for the Arts and Humanities. You can hear much more of our conversation at newsworks.org. That's all for tonight's show. Newsworks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for Newsworks Tonight.